Recently, the UN Security Council urged warring sites in Yemen to extend the truce, saying it has had tangible benefits for the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. So far, there are no signs of agreement from both parties.
A complete end to the war and siege is what Yemenis are demanding from the international community, including the United Nations. They say the temporary truce should not be extended since the world body has failed to ensure its full implementation. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
British police have found themselves embroiled in another racism scandal, this time surrounding the killing of an unarmed black man in South London by armed officers on the 5th of September. Following an alleged police pursuit, 24-year-old Chris Carber was behind the wheel of a car hemmed in by two police vehicles in a narrow street before one round was fired, ending his life. He leaves behind a fiancée and an unborn child. No gun was found in the car.
Thousands of protesters have descended outside police headquarters in central London to vent their fury over what they say is gross injustice being carried out by the authorities against Chris and his family. Accusations are swirling around, some of which include that the police who stopped Chris on that fateful day may have known who was inside the car in the lead up to the fatal shooting. This is, of course, all being investigated, but the protest organisers have made absolutely clear that they are going to refuse to back down until the demands of the family are met and justice be served.
Fighting back the tears, family members spoke of their ordeal after seeing the body for the first time since the killing. News of the shooting has caused uproar, especially in the black community. They feel this was just another example of a racist system out to harm them. Following the backlash, the officer responsible for the shooting has been suspended. An investigation is also underway, but the police watchdog warned it could take 9 months to reach a conclusion. The family expressed anger at the lengthy wait. However, the question of race playing a role will be examined as a factor, providing some small hope that the family's demands will be answered. Robert Carter, London.
We here at Arab English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 28th of Safar, the anniversary of the divine ascension of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is also the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace be upon him, the second infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners on this day of double grief.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The war between Russia and Ukraine is now in its ninth month, while people in four Ukrainian regions have started voting in referendums on joining Russia. Kiev claims to have expanded its territorial gains in the east. Moscow is now saying the West has become part of the war by supplying military aid and information to Kiev, and is accusing the West of nuclear blackmail. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll discuss the latest developments of the conflict and the West's role and the prolongation of the war. Joining us on the program, we have activist and political analyst, and George Samueli, senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute from London Metropolitan University, joining us from Budapest. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Bosnich in Belgrade. Sir, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned the West that Moscow would use all available means to respond to threats against its territorial integrity. Putin also ordered Russia's first mobilization since World War II. What is your perspective on the recent developments with regards to the Ukraine conflict?
Well, I think that President Putin has made it very clear that he's not bluffing in this matter whatsoever, and that he intends to proceed with the integration of the ethnic Russian population of Ukraine into the Russian Federation, as that seems to be the only way to protect them from a war of genocide by the Ukrainian government.
George Samueli, Putin is accusing Western countries of engaging in nuclear blackmail and trying to destroy Russia. Can you explain what he means by that term, nuclear blackmail?
Well, I think that he means that the Western powers are essentially threatening Russia with nuclear war and thereby warning Russia away from continuing its ongoing military operations. But I think what he is really getting at here is that Russia will do whatever is necessary to protect its sovereignty and territorial integrity. And as Mr. Bosnich pointed out, following the referendums and the inevitable incorporation of these territories within the Russian Federation, that means henceforth any attacks on those territories will be regarded as attacks on the Russian Federation. And Russia has now said that we will respond with all means at our disposal on any attack on our territorial integrity.
John Bosnich, John, speaking at the United Nations Security Council, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said countries supplying weapons to Ukraine and training its soldiers were parties to the conflict, adding that, quote, the intentional fomenting of this conflict by the collective West remained unpunished. The question is, will this support that Western countries are giving Ukraine result in this conflict spilling over into other regions and possibly turning into something bigger?
Well, that's always a possibility because the NATO powers seem to have lost their heads. They don't realize the seriousness of this situation. Ukraine cannot be seen without reference to Russia. Ukraine, the current territory known as Ukraine, was in fact the first settlement area of the Russian nation. There was a country called Rus, which was headquartered and its capital was Kiev. And so the fact that this conflict is taking place around Kiev and around the original historic heartland of the Russian people is indicative of how central and how important this is to the current Russian government in Moscow. The Western powers, for some reason, seem to think that a line drawn on a map has created in Ukraine some kind of a Western-oriented NATO military colony. They are so wrong that it can't be put into words.
George Samueli in Budapest, speaking at the United Nations General Assembly, U.S. President Joe Biden strongly denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine, warning U.N. member states that, quote, if a nation can pursue imperial ambitions without consequences, then we put at risk everything this great institution stands for. It sounds like the kettle calling the pot black.
Yeah, it does indeed. And of course, what Biden said, and it's said repeated ad nauseum by the other NATO leaders, Emmanuel Macron, Liz Truss, Olaf Scholz, I will say the same thing, is that Russia, out of the blue, attacked Ukraine, unprovoked, unjustified aggression against the neighbor. This, of course, is completely untrue. Because, of course, this conflict has been going on for a considerable amount of time, at least for 8 years since essentially Ukraine launched a war against its own Russian-speaking population and failed to implement an agreement that was reached at Minsk I agreement, Minsk II agreement, which was in fact incorporated within a UN Security Council resolution. So this was a UN Security Council resolution that supposedly the Western powers supported, but in fact did nothing whatever to coerce Kiev to attempt to implement. In fact, Kiev has admitted, or the former President Poroshenko admitted, that he was never had the slightest intention to implement Minsk. He was instead just buying time pretending to be interested in implementing agreement, but actually using the time to become stronger and stronger. And NATO willingly cooperated with this, pouring in arms for 8 years into Ukraine with a view, obviously, to mounting basically a genocidal campaign against the Russian-speaking population, meaning they would just simply had the plan to drive them out altogether. So, but of course, that disappears from the view of the Western leaders, who just simply go back to the story. Oh, Russia just one day woke up and decided to attack Ukraine. Nothing at all happened beforehand. So, what Biden says is the way Western media and Western politicians interpret what's going on. Completely untrue.
John Bozich, the European Union is planning to impose new sanctions against Russia. The EU High Representative added Europe will continue to support Ukraine and provide it with military equipment as long as needed. Surely this will send ripple effects up and down the global market again. Tell us more about the ramifications of these measures and its repercussions for Europe, especially as winter approaches.
Well, I certainly wouldn't just call it ripple effects. I would call it a reverse tsunami. Yeah, exactly. Okay. What we've got here is every sanction that the Western powers, I prefer to call them just the American military colonies, in effect, every sanction they put on Russia is going to boomerang and hit them back twice as hard as it hits Russia. Russia has secured an export market for its primary export product, which is petroleum products, and the buyer is China. And China is not just a passive buyer. China is also a strong military power, which has an interest in maintaining the strength and integrity of Russia. So in every sanction that the Western military alliance puts on Russia, they are tightening the cooperation between Russia and China, and Russia and other countries such as Iran, which is attempting to pursue its own independent development. That's point one. Point number two. Under the current regime of sanctions, the energy crisis in Europe has reached such a stage that the European economies are going to collapse. When the European economies collapse, the people of Europe are going to look at their leaders and ask them, are you the leaders of our nations, or are you nothing more than American marionettes? If the public of Europe comes to the conclusion that their ruling class are all marionettes of a foreign power, we could see the collapse of the post-World War II U.S.-controlled European structures. And if that happens, this situation would not be a war, but it would be a tectonic shift of power in the entire world.
George Samuel, British Prime Minister Liz Truss has announced that in the following year, the UK will meet or exceed the amount of military aid spent on Ukraine in 2022. Is the UK in a position right now, in your opinion, to splash more money on military assistance to Ukraine rather than focus on its own economic troubles? Apart from that, interestingly, a British MP has said spending more on military aid to Ukraine will cut energy bills. How is that possible?
Well, of course, it isn't possible. And as you say, the UK does not have this kind of money. And the only way it can do so is if it starts printing money. But given that inflation in the UK is already on course to be around 20% by January, there is just simply no way that the UK can come up with this sort of money. But the issue, however, is a more serious one than that, because if the UK does indeed throw in this heavy military hardware into Ukraine, and this hardware is going to be used on Russian people, which is what's going to happen if Ukraine is going to continue with its war, then, of course, UK is explicitly a party to this war, and therefore the consequences could be quite serious for the UK. But almost certainly, Russia will respond by cutting off all energy exports to Europe altogether. I mean, it's not just going to be, well, it'll be 20% or 30% or whatever. It's going to be 0%. And when that happens, then I think the European economies will just come tumbling down. I mean, German economy is already, and that's the powerhouse of Europe, is already in a very precarious position. And once it's completely cut off, I think there's just going to be a complete collapse within Europe. And then we'll see what the political consequences will be, because this is an entirely unnecessary war in the first place, and it was entirely unnecessary for the European powers to get themselves into a war that had nothing to do with them and did not in any way threaten their security. So they've got themselves into this absolute catastrophe for no intelligible reason whatsoever, and I would indeed expect that there would be enormous political ramifications.
Mr. Bozich, let's put some focus on events on the ground. Ukraine claims to have reclaimed major swaths of territory with its counteroffensives, forcing Russian troops to retreat. I want to get your thoughts on that. Do you think it's due to the assistance that it's getting from the U.S. and its allies? And is this just what the U.S. and the NATO wants, this conflict to be a prolonged one, to see it dragged out for as long as possible in the hopes that it weakens Russia?
When the military historians look back on this conflict, they are going to praise the Russian generals and the Russian general staff for the brilliant way in which they pursued the battle. The recent gains, so-called gains by the Ukrainian army, especially in the northeastern region around Kharkov, have been taken at the expense of several hundred Russian soldiers and the loss of more than 4,700 Ukrainian soldiers. We're talking a death count up to 20 times higher on the Ukrainian side. And what they've achieved is they've inherited an area of empty ground with no resources and nothing of any value. What has happened here is Russia has arranged a strategic withdrawal which drew in a Ukrainian army, their best reserves, put them on an open plain, and allowed them to be destroyed from the air. Now, this is what Russia could have done to the city of Kiev at the beginning of the war and chose not to do in the interests of finding a negotiated solution. Now that Kiev has made it clear, and the NATO colonies, NATO military colonies in the EU, have backed it up, it looks like time for real war. Real war means that Russia is going to withdraw its strategic reserves from other areas and put them into the battle. Now, Russia is a country of 145 million people. It can easily put another 300,000 men in the field, and these are not green recruits. These are people who have already gone through military training and have served in the Russian military. Ukraine has no such recruits available. It will be a walkover if it becomes a full-scale war. And if it's a walkover, this is not just the defeat of Ukraine, but the defeat of NATO. And we can see the very, very high possibility that NATO itself will fracture and will lose member countries, starting with Romania and Hungary.
George Samuel, your referendums on joining Russia are due to take place from today until Tuesday in several largely Russian-held regions in the east and in the south of Ukraine, which, as a matter of fact, comprise around 15% of the country's territory. Ukraine and its allies have said that such votes would be illegal. The UN chief also has expressed concerns over the referendums. What is your take on the issue of these referendums being held?
Well, we can be pretty sure that the referendum will be overwhelmingly in favor of joining the Russian Federation. We also know that the constitutional process of incorporating these territories within the Russian Federation will be accomplished very quickly. If you remember how it was with Crimea in 2014, it was done very quickly. So the State Duma will pass appropriate legislation, and then President Putin will sign it, and these territories will be a part of Russia. And of course, it now means that Ukraine will be targeting, if it continues the war, and it says it intends to continue the war, the NATO powers. All of them have said, yeah, nothing changes. We don't care about any referendum. We're going to continue doing everything that we've been doing. Well, that means that they are ready to escalate to a full-scale war with Russia. And of course, Russia, you know, can easily insert this 300,000 reserves and more. It's a big country. The casualties that Russia has sustained so far are vastly dwarfed by the casualties sustained by Ukraine, which is, you know, about a third, you know, maybe even about a quarter of Russia's size. So as Russia escalates, Ukraine has no means of escalating because it's already sustained casualties. Now, the Russians have estimated that Ukrainians have lost about 60,000 killed in action. That may be true or may not be true. We don't know for sure, but most estimates are in that ballpark. So Ukraine doesn't have any additional manpower that it can draw upon other than if NATO were to get directly involved themselves. Well, you know, this is the time for, you know, NATO to put up or shut up. I mean, having said all this time, well, we're not directly involved in this war. We're not party to it. Well, you know, Kyiv is going to turn to them and say, okay, are you ready to get directly involved? I suspect that they're not, in which case they will have no choice but to tell Kyiv it's time to knock it off. Now, it's possible that they're so stupid and they're so crazy that they will get involved directly. Unfortunately, for NATO, they're not really in any position in that part of Europe to wage any kind of a war against Russia. It's a hell of a big undertaking for them to get kind of manpower into Ukraine.
John Bosnich, John. Final question to you in retrospect. Could the U.S. and NATO, could have acted differently to de-escalate the situation altogether? Russia put forth its request Ukraine can't join NATO, no more eastward expansion of the military alliance. What do you think?
Well, in fact, they can't do that because the sole purpose of NATO is to drive to the east, or as Hitler and the Kaisers before him called it, Drang nach Osten. It's a perpetual desire of the Central European powers grouped around the former Austro-Hungarian Empire and Imperial Germany. This is the fundamental reason for NATO. And when I look at the data here, it's not that NATO has become involved in this war. NATO is this war. Zelensky is NATO's puppet. Ukraine is a victim of NATO's foreign policy. And when I look at the list of what charges can be laid against the NATO leadership, I don't even know where one would start. Torture, ethnic cleansing, genocide, Nazi revanchism, the creation and violation of media rights, and the fundamental violation of the human rights of not only the ethnic Russian citizens of Ukraine, but the ethnic Ukrainian citizens of Ukraine who've been tricked and cheated into a war that should have never taken place. Where the prosecution will begin, I don't know. But where it will end, I do know. In Kyiv.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, journalists, activists, and political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from Belgrade, and also senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute, Mr. George Samueli, joining us from Budapest. Thank you for contributing to the show. It's good night for now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Women's epic participation in 8-year holy defense. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. When the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein started the 8-year war against Iran on September 22, 1980, Iranian women took serious part in the war beside men. Women mainly participated in preparation and logistics behind the fronts, while many of the women in the war-stricken areas directly helped men in defending their land against the Iraqi invasion. These women found a role model in the ladies of the first years of Islam, particularly Hazrat Fatima and Hazrat Zainab, peace upon them. Today we are going to give some of the statistics on women's role in the war, and then you will get acquainted with a few of these great ladies. According to the statistics of the 8-year Holy Defense, 6,428 women were martyred during the imposed war, most of whom were martyred in bombardment and missile attacks of cities by the Iraqi army. 500 of these women, however, were combatants. Most of these women were single, and 2,500 of them were in the age of 10 to 30. It is noteworthy that 22,808 female relief forces and 2,276 female physicians were sent to the fronts during the war. Moreover, there were 5,735 war invalids among the Iranian women during the 8-year war. Furthermore, the number of Iran's female POWs was 171. Although a huge bulk of the country's revenues was spent for the war, the government was not able to afford all expenses, especially due to the bad economic conditions. Thus, people's participation was quintessential in the logistics and support of the war. In view of this, women played an unforgettable and effective role behind the fronts. Hundreds of thousands of women spent days and nights at the headquarters of logistics to accumulate and pack whatever the combatants needed at the battlefronts. Esmat Ahmadian is the mother of two martyrs and one war invalid. She used to drive a pickup truck to the fronts for packing the forces in Ahvaz. She would also wash the clothes of combatants and even prepare breakfast for them. She says, "War is an evil phenomenon, but the fronts and the people there were lovely and the defense was a sacred thing." Fatima Nawab Safavi, the granddaughter of martyr Nawab Safavi, was another brave woman who had gone to Bahmanshir River as a watchdog. She had played a great role in bringing information on the enemy's position. Ms. Majide Nagravi was a girl who, during the liberation of Susangird in November 1980, bravely disarmed 8 invading soldiers and officers and captivated them. She says, when the Iraqi army was defeated in Hamidiye, the panicked enemy soldiers tried to shoot at civilians to escape towards the border, but they didn't know the way to reach there. When 6 soldiers approached our house, I told them, if you go forward further, you will be besieged by the people and IRGC forces and will be killed. Enter the house immediately, sit in the dining room, and give me your arms to hide them. They did as I told them. When they were disarmed, I locked the door behind them and called people. So we took them to the mosque with the weapons that I had taken from them. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says, if women had not chanted the epic of war and had not considered the war as a value, men would not have found the motive to go to the war, and the huge masses of besieged forces would not have set out for France. Dr. Masume Abad was working as a member of the Red Crescent Society in Khorramshahr when she was captivated with other three ladies by the Iraqi invading forces. She was imprisoned for 40 months in the Iraqi camp till she was set free in 1983. She says, "The captivity of body is nothing in comparison with the captivity of soul. Those who stood firmly and kept their dignity and honor with perseverance and steadfastness know it well, that the real captives are the ones who sell their spirit at a low price to grow their body, while human body is small and worthless without the soul." Iranian women played a significant role in cultural arena of the war. This would be seen in promotion, veneration of martyrs, confronting hypocrites and rumors of counter-revolutionary elements, funeral and marking of martyrs, writing books, journalism, composing of poems, and so on. Women were good narrators of the 8-year holy defense, and they created a lot of valuable works in that brilliant period of the Iranian history. The memoirs of women who had participated in the war, the stories of mothers, sisters, wives, and daughters of martyrs depicted beautiful pages and chapters in book of the great epic of combatants in the war. Zahra Hosseini is the narrator of the famous book Da. The book is a true narration of whatever this brave lady had seen and felt during the first month and years of the holy defense. She lived in Khorramshahr and she was 17 years old at that time. This great lady buried her father and brother after their martyrdom during the defense of the city. Her report of the war is one of the unique books on the 8-year imposed war. Fahime Babayanpour and Ghulam Reza Sadeghzadeh married at the presence of Imam Khomeini. While pronouncing them as husband and wife, the girl told Imam Khomeini, "I accept his proposal under the condition that you pray for us to be martyred in this world and promise to intercede for us in the hereafter." It was due to this high morale that the Imam had said, "When I see these respectable ladies who are ready with resolve and decisive will on the way for any kind of trouble, even martyrdom, I become sure that this path will end in victory." Elsewhere in his remarks, Imam Khomeini said, "It is an honor for this great stratum which have made the Islamic country, the noble Quran, and the revolution victorious with their precious and courageous participation at the scene of defense, and now they are active at the fronts and behind the fronts and ready for self-sacrifice."
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yeah. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
We here at Arab English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 28th of Safar, the anniversary of the divine ascension of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is also the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace be upon him, the second infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners on this day of double grief.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.